It's Beans on Toast. I'm a folk singer, songwriter and performer. I'm here on the Proper Job podcast. If you want to find out more about me, you can Google Beans on Toast, because it took me ages to work up the bloody Google search engines to get above Jamie Oliver recipes and whatnot, but I did it. I'm right there at the top. Or you can just listen to the podcast coming up right now.
Right, let's get stuck in, shall we?
Where did the journey start into music? Where, was it a young age thing?
Teenager, I guess. Yeah, I mean, as far as sort of writing songs and making music, yeah, I just started in a... Me and my mates at school started a grunge band, basically. And we started the band before we could play any instruments, like all three of us, you know. It was definitely an attitude thing more than it was like, oh, we feel like we're really gifted with this sort of like musical ability. It was just like, let's start a band, you know. And we came up with a name and all the, like, we graffitied the name around school, all that stuff. And then it was like, right, what the hell are we, I guess we're going to have to, you know, try and make some music now. And we just sort of divvied it out. It's like, and I knew, even then, like, I knew I wanted to kind of write the words, certainly. Like, and it took us, you know, months until we realised we had to play the same notes. Like, at the just to begin with, the bass player would just do a bass line that he thought was cool. I'd just play some guitar that I thought was cool. Not, you know, we played gigs before we knew that you had to play music, you know. I mean, I guess we might have been in time, but we certainly wasn't in tune with each other.
So kind of like jumped in at a deep end and just find out how it goes along the way.
Yeah, I think we knew that we'd like, no one really sort of told us. And it was, we thought it was like, we never asked, I guess. We just was like, yeah, we'll start a band and just start making music. And because, yeah, like it looked legit. The other band were doing it. We got into their rehearsal room. We got a gig supporting them at the Army and Navy, which was where we all wanted to go. Really? You think that someone would have gone, guys, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you can't, like, it sounds awful. Like, I'd like to think that if I saw someone doing that, even I wouldn't try and sort of dissuade them from doing it, but I'd be like, fucking hell, you need to, you know, spend a bit more time in the rehearsal room. I'm glad that someone didn't dissuade me, but when we realised, we thought it was a revelation, of course, that, you know, playing the same notes in music is not a revelation at all, you know, it's essential, really. But yeah, so, you know, it started from there. And instantly, similar to what's kind of how it's been for me throughout, we didn't have the ability to play anybody else's songs. So the only thing we knew to do was to write our own. And we got really, as we learned to play in tune, you know, the band stayed together for years and we could write songs, you know, like nobody's business. We'd just write a song and in the afternoon and gig it that night. Yeah, you know, and that's what it is about for me now, is this, you know, if it's anything that I do, if you was to, you know, on my career advice form that I'm about to fill out, if I am anything, I guess I'd put, you know, songwriter and performer, really.
So you gigged it for a while. What was the name of this band?
Jellico.
Jellico, okay. So you gigged it for a while, what, in the local area, or did you go sort of national?
Yeah, we did all right. I mean, I used to sing in a high-pitched American accent as well, just to paint the real picture of what was going on. With, like, you know, we was big, like, Placebo fans, and, you know, I'd paint my nails, rip my jeans, and sing like this in a really high-pitched accent. Which, you know, is so strange to think of now. But we gigged loads in Essex, and we used to do coaches. We had loads of mates at the time, and there was other people that were in bands. So there was a bit of a thing, like, you know, as far as Braintree was concerned in our lives, you know, it was huge, you know. So we the Army and Navy in Chelmsford, and we used to get a bus. It was like a half-hour journey. And we'd pay for the bus out of our own money so that all our mates could come to the gig. And it'd just, like, it'd be a fucking riot. And we had a good deal with the coach company that used to drive us around, I guess, needed the money because they was willing to take, you know, a bunch of hammered 18-year-olds wherever they wanted to go. So the gigs were cool. And we did, like, you know, we got better. We did a John Peel session. Like, John Peel rang my house. We went up, me and Dave, the drummer from the band, who, you know, still my best mate, and a lot of the stuff that the sort of work that I've done over the years has been me and Dave side by side, basically. And we went up to London to you know, give out our demos, basically. And we, like, knocked on the door of loads of record labels. It was fucking well easy as well. We got, like, sat down for meetings at, like, Food Records, which was who Blur was signed to and stuff, just from ringing the door buzzer and, like, oh, let us in, like, giving out, getting gigs and giving out flyers. And we went into Radio 1, just walked in to, the like, the main building. I was like, is John Peel here? And she was like, oh, it's this woman at reception said, oh, we've just missed him. You know, but you can leave something in his pigeonhole. So we just wrote out a little note, put it with a CD in the pigeonhole. And like about 2 months later, John Peel phoned my house phone where I lived with my mum and dad at the time. It was just like, it's John Peel from Radio 1. Going to play you on the radio. And then he didn't play it for another 3 weeks. And I think it might have been something he used to do to get listenership up. Because we sat and listened to the John Peel show every night for 3 weeks, waiting for our song to be played. And I mean, obviously the guy's a hero, but bloody hell, then 3 weeks he played some nonsense.
Yeah. He probably had like another 600 people he'd call in as well at the same time.
Yeah, it's just ringing everybody saying, I'm going to play you soon. Listen out. And it's like listenership's going up. Could have been good tactic if that was the case.
Did those kind of things then like spur you on a little bit then?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, obviously getting a phone call from John Peel. You know, we put out an album and I was, there's the kind of difference between how I felt when I was doing the Jellicoe stuff and how it was when I started what I do now, the sort of Beans on Toast sort of side of songwriting and performing was, as a teenager with that band, I was ambitious. You know, I wanted the band like to, you know, I was like, we have to all move to London for the band. We need to sign a record. You know, I was sort of like, I had an ambition where I don't know what I wanted, but you know, the band to be big, I guess. And it was, that's the kind of the polar opposite of the mindset of how it went down when I started Beans on Toast, basically. But so I had way more, you know, for the better or worse, you know, I certainly had a kind of teenage drive behind us, as we all did, you know, and like it was exciting, you know, and then as we did move out in Essex and we was, you know, three of us were there living in London. Oh, we got, you know, Dave got a job in Tower Records. I got a job at a music venue and we got gigs and sign management and, you know, we put an album out and it all sort of, you know, it's pretty classic, but it all sort of fell apart quite quickly. And basically because everybody else was slow, you know, as soon as we started working with other people, it was like, oh, we're going to pay for you to make an album, but on our timescale. And it, you know, we just sat around waiting around and we didn't really know how to wait around. We only knew how to drive forward, but people would tell us, you can't do this until you've done the album, blah, blah. So it's like other people kind of put a stop to it. And then without the ball rolling, it just sort of fell apart. But I never stopped writing songs, you know, since that first song that I wrote when I was 16. Just never stopped. And it was years after that. Then Jot, the bass player, moved back to Essex. And me and Dave, where we had that kind of, we'd been used to promoting shows for us, and the band fell apart. So we got into club promoting, basically. And we started, I was handing out flyers. Which was, if this is a, you know, a podcast about jobs, was the, you know, essentially I'm the glorified flyer guy. You know, that was, I loved that job. You know, I moved to London, I gave out flyers for clubs, and it was, you know, the amount of people that I met, you know, you could drink, you hung out, you was outside, no one was watching you or on your back.
Done that myself, mate. Outside Retros in Cardiff.
Yeah, I loved it. I flew for years, you know. And from there, it was like, and from knowing how to fly, we started our own club nights, basically. And I did that for years, you know. And then started from that promoting and living in bars. And I was still writing songs, but never really... not performing them or not giving it a name or giving it a drive. That all come sort of way later once we had, you know, the clubs were fucking banging, you know, and I was living above a pub that was like turning over. It was basically the kind of trick behind Beans on Toast was that I had other shit going on. Like the pub was good and the clubs were good. So I didn't need anything from it. Like I said, it didn't have that. It wasn't like, oh, this has got to be, I want this to be a big thing, or I need this to earn money or anything like that. It was purely, you know, it was just for just for the fun, which meant I could do what I want, say what I want. No one was relying on it. Didn't have anybody telling me what I could and couldn't do. And that, what I learned over the years, was what the appeal was. You know, certainly in them early days. I mean, I used to get fucking hammered when I played gigs, like more hammered than anybody should. And really, I think that's what people, you know, that's what people were up for. It's just because it was like, wow, it was so careless, it became entertaining. And that's not what it is now, but that's certainly, you know, how it was when it started.
It comes across now that there is an anti-establishment there, I'd say. Did that come from the way you were before?
Not really. I think I just learned a little bit more about how things go. I also managed bands for a spell, you know, and I'd been putting on gigs. I managed, like, Dave, the drummer from the original band, he started a band called The Holloways, and he drummed for them, and I managed them. And, you know, we had sort of, you know, top 20 chart success, toured around the world and shit. So it's like, I saw it from that aspect as well. And again, it was just because there was never any plan. It wasn't like, I need to be DIY or I need to, or not. It was just like, I just do it because it's fun and it's easy. And it basically, it sort of fed itself, you know, without asking for gigs. Every gig that I did, I got offered another one. I was going to a lot of festivals at the time, just, you know, jumping over fences or blagging in with other bands and whatnot. And every time that I blagged a gig at a festival, you know, I got a booking the next year or for another festival around that. And again, I realised that the best thing about it was that I was never, wasn't pushing it out there at all. And it was just sort of like letting it happen. And, you know, and obviously if you're kind of getting celebrated and because you're getting hammered, then you just get more. So I just sort of dive more into it. And again, you know, and I still kept, for years I kept, you know, for the first sort of maybe sort of 5 years, I guess, of doing it, I was like, I was living above a pub, working at the pub, you know, putting on shows at the pub, and the pub changed 2 or 3 times, but that was the deal. So I had my rent covered and I had, you know, like I had money coming in. And obviously it was good to get paid for shows, but I wasn't reliant on it. So again, I could kind of pick and choose. I could just do what I wanted. And that was the sort of playing field in which it was created. And it was lovely when the pubs fell apart and I could just turn to music as a kind of sole source of income. But, I was lucky that I had that kind of, I was in that position basically to be able to let it happen for so long without needing the finance or the support from it. So I, you know, I'm a completely believer in universal basic income, you know, which basically says, you know, it says that if people are, it sounds really cheesy, isn't it? But it's like, you know, like do what you love basically, and then you'll love what you do, you know, is the kind of.
Be driven by your passion.
Yeah, exactly that. Concentrate on that and let give it time to do its own thing without being too demanding from it. So hey, it could let and sort of burn by itself until it's enough to kind of like keep you going, you know, further down the line by itself.
So it wasn't a clear cut that then Beans on Toast was like created. Was it like this organic evolution of what you're saying, or was it more that at some point you pushed it?
It was the songs that I just started. Basically, I'll tell you what it was. Think about it now. It was, I was still, when the band split up and I was still writing, I was still singing in this god awful American accent. And I met a guy, I met this dude at a party who we kind of got on, and he ended up, he basically came back from to mine after the party and didn't leave for about 3 weeks, and it ended as a bit of a nightmare. But for a while, and it, you know, he was a really good songwriter, and I started playing him these songs. And instantly, when I started singing one of my songs for him, he was like, "What the fuck are you doing? Like, why are you singing in that stupid voice?" And it was almost like I know what I'm like, and I'm quite hard to be told. You know, like my friends and family, like I had, at the same time, for an example, I had these awful fucking dreadlocks, like really natty, rank horrible dreadlocks. And when I cut them off, everybody was like, oh my God, fat, you should have done that years ago. And I was like, why didn't anybody tell me? And I was like, because you can't be told. You know, like nobody fucking dare. And it was a little, must have been a little bit like that with my silly singing as well, because no one had the heart or no one wanted to. And this guy was just like, mate, what the fuck? He goes, you've got an interesting voice. You're not American. You're just ruining these songs. And he kind of hammered it into me, and that really sowed a seed. So I started, and at the same time, I started listening to a guy called Chris TT, who's like a great songwriter, and particularly English. And I sort of was like, wow, you know, what am I doing? And I started writing songs in my own voice, basically, and was like, right, this is it. This is what I want to do. You know, these songs are different. I came up with it, and that was where it's like, it's really English. So Beans on Toast seemed like a good name for it. And at the time, I think my plan was I'll start a band, find some musicians, start a band. And I just was writing loads of songs. And then I just played them at Glastonbury. I was at Glastonbury for some other reason, again, working there or whatever. And it wasn't even like an open mic tent. There was just a guy finished playing and the guitar was left there, and my friend was like, you should go and do one of them songs, you know, you were singing at home the other day. So I just jumped up and, you know, and a lot of the songs were about getting hammered at festivals, you know, and singing to a bunch of hammered people at a festival. But halfway through the first song, I was like, fuck starting a band. This is it. Like, this is all I need. And it was like, but you know, it was so instantaneous because the songs were very matter of fact, and it was all about the words rather than the music anyway. And I really, so quickly it connected. That tent was just like, by the time it finished, I had another Beans on Toast gig, like at another festival, like I said, and it was like, all right. And I went back and I was like, right, no band, I'll take the band name, use it as a moniker, and you know, and that's it, that's me done. And that, you know, it's been an absolute godsend, because all of the there's so many things that I do that just wouldn't fly as a band, just financially, you know, to be honest, you know, like this, the music that I make, you know, it can sort me out and has done now for years, you know, and now it can sort my family out. But, you know, like at the early days, there's no way I could have toured with four mouths to feed or, you know, or 12 mouths to feed. You know, it was like the fact that it was just me meant, and I, you know, I fucking sleep anywhere and eat nothing if there was a gig going, you know. So it's like, and there was no arguments to be had. There was no, there's no up and down about artwork or videos. I make every decision that needs to be made. I make it quickly and I fly through it. So it's just like, it being the fact that it's just me is the only reason that it's lasted anywhere near as long as it has. So yeah, you know, thank fuck I got up that day at Glasto and, you know, strummed that chord out. Otherwise it might have been a completely different start. It might have been involving other people before we ever did a gig and then trying to, you know, make that work through a different means. But, you know, no point pondering on things like that.
No, you obviously just go with the flow, mate. What about like looking at like present day with like, say, digital? You know, you look at YouTube and you look at Spotify versus, you know, those older days of like selling records. And like you said, you're buzzing on the places of these studios and management and having a little word with them. You're not going to be like an old man and say like, you know, it was better in my day, but it was it, you know. Simply, was it better then? Or
nah, no way. Like, I mean, it wasn't better or worse, you know, it's just different.
Is exposure better, you know, now though?
I mean, during lockdown, I sat at home and, you know, recorded a song into my phone. I made a video and then I uploaded the video. I sent the song to Spotify and I released that song to the world effectively without leaving my a room or my chair, you know, like, and the whole world could listen to it. And, you know, how can you knock that? I mean, the irony was one of the songs on the record is about how the internet's fucking with our minds, you know. So it's, you know, so I guess swings and roundabouts, but you can't not acknowledge that that's a good thing, you know. And I'm sure, I mean, I guess, I think if I started doing my music now, I'd probably, I guess I'm lucky because I got in where it's like, I was touring more before. So it's like, there was still a way. I feel like if I wrote MDMA's in now, it'd just be like a sort of little throwaway viral hit, you know, that was just like, I see these amazing songs pop up across the internet where the name of the band is nowhere to be seen. And it's got like millions of views and everyone's like, oh yeah. And it's like, it sort of breaks my heart. And that's, I often sort of think, fuck, that could have happened. You know, just, you could have just been that, just name not got mentioned, let alone like a link to your gigs or anything like that. And people just go, oh, that's cool, that's funny, move along.
Is that the song that you are like, for stranger people who don't particularly know like the rest of your albums, is that the one that everyone knows you for?
Yeah, oh yeah, big time. Yeah, yeah. And that's the one on, you know, like up there at the top on Spotify and stuff like that.
I'm at a pre-goer festival with a bag of MDMA. Well, we both took a great big dab and went to greet the day. Now I warn you, this shit tastes foul when you put it in your gob. But try to swallow all of it, it'll knock your fucking socks off.
People will often sort of say, oh no, you must really hate, you know, that. And it's like, that's the song that's done me more good than any of my other songs. I love it. I play it every gig, like, of course. It's what people fucking want as well, isn't it? It's like, and you know, and it's, the hilarity is like, how little I knew, like when I'm writing it, you know, again, like I was just trying to get the girl to, you know, talk to me more was the simple thing. Right?
Was that in the, what, teens or 20s?
20s, yeah. Yeah, it would have been like 26, so late 20s, yeah. I mean, I'm married now, but I was, you know, still writing songs about beautiful women.
When I say like the Spotify and the YouTube, one thing there is the money side of thing. You know, I talked about exposure. What about paying like these artists fairly?
I'm into it, to be honest. And like, I know that there's a big sort of conversation where it's like, you know, and I'm not here to say that people shouldn't get paid more at all, but I'm also not going to complain about my lot. Like, I have, because of the way that I own all my music, and you know, I get paid a fair bit from Spotify. You know, like, the money's good. It's better than any other job I've ever had. You know, like, considering what, you know, like, and when you, I can make it work, basically. Again, there's not five of me. You know, if I was a 12-piece ska band, we'd be screwed. And I'm certainly not going to say, oh, hell, I don't want any more. But I also think that, I think Spotify is the sort of, it's easy, it's kind of shooting the messenger a little bit. I think the major, a lot of the problem is that, like, it's old school record deals where people are locked. It's like the big major labels that lock people in to weird deals and then give them fuck all, which is kind of the history of the music business throughout. You know, there's nothing new there. But it's just like they're trying to stick to, you know, when there was loads of money made in music, when really you need to, you know, it just needs to evolve into a way. I mean, there's another thing. And again, it's, you know, I feel like saying this is just going to sort of wind people up. But, you know, why should musicians get paid so much? You know, my mission has never been to make fucking millions of pounds. You know, if I can make the same amount that people are making that are, you know, I don't know, plumbing, yeah, you know, or, yeah, well, or sort well of hard craft.
Just to get by.
Yeah, or just like, and it's also, I think it's a kind of unsung song as well, where it's like it's always seen that if you're making music, it has to constantly be in bigger rooms, selling more, doing that. It's rather that what I've been doing for so long, and I do it on an annual basis. I go back to the same venue in Leeds, for example. I played the Brudenell Social Club every year. In December, obviously we won't get stuck into this year, but you know, every year I'll go to Brudenell Social Club, it'll fill up, it'll be a great night. And it's like, and there's promoters, people that go, where are we going next? It's like, we're not going anywhere. You know, we're fucking staying here. It's my favourite venue. It's the right size. We can fill it up. It works for everybody. Rather than push it too far and then have to fall off, let's just cultivate it at this level where it works for me. It works for, I mean, the person that I do work with, the team behind Beans on Toast, is myself and a booking agent. guy called Adam Gainsborough, and he books my shows and above and beyond the call of duty. If there's kind of sort of management duties that I don't do myself, or, you know, I don't want to do or can't do, he'll sort of step in and do. So between the two of us, you know, we're best of friends. And then on the other side is my wife, who, you know, helps me get my head around all the kind of merch and sending stuff out and bits and bobs like that. So it's like super small team. We all like it, and we spend our time, you know, trying to make sure we can continue doing it at the level that we do it at, and almost try and perfect that rather than, you know, having our sort of aim set on, oh, it's got to be bigger and it's got to be. And I'm not saying that if there was, you know, if more people wanted to come to the show, we'd obviously put more tickets on sale. But I'd almost tempted to say we'd just do two nights in the same room, you know, something like that.
Sounds like there's a clear case of like the being content and being motivated by greed. You know, you sound like you're in a good place at the moment.
Yeah, well, I'm happy, you know, happy and healthy. So, yeah, there and I suppose it's like I said, it began from a place without a plan and without a sort of a mission statement. And that is what, you know, I really think that is what drew people to it, you know, was the, and hopefully now, yeah, that is still a similar thing. That's what people are getting from the shows when they're coming, that it's not, you know, we're there to have a good time and, you know, and to sing the songs. And that's, you know, there's nothing more than that here. There's nothing hidden. There's no smoke and mirrors. It's just like, we're going to sing some songs, get pissed, have a good time, you know, and talk and laugh and think about the world, you know, and just like, and that's it.
Is there a motivator in your songs, like to get messages over? Is that always the case, or sometimes does that take a back seat?
No, I actually think my songs have probably shaped me more than I've shaped my songs. Like, it's quite an incredible thing, kind of constantly feeling the need to sort of like explain your inner thoughts. You know, half the time, you know, like if I didn't do it, I'd forget how I felt, you know, or maybe from night to night, you know, but there's something about writing it down and, you know, and then memorizing it and then traveling around, belting it out to other people, like a diary, a diary of how you feel and how you think. And, you know, and once you commit that to memory, it makes you feel and think them things stronger than you would have done without them. And so I think songs, you know, I don't really know where I am when I'm writing songs. You know, that's the sort of beauty of, you know, of the best songs are written in a kind of, almost like a dream state, that way you just like, oh, I've got, oh yeah, I've got a song. I don't know what I was, if you sit down and think, right, now I've got to write a song, it never really comes. But if it's like, if you're not thinking about it, then a sort of doorway opens and the song just sort of turns up. And so, or when I say turns up, it's more that it comes out, I suppose, almost sort of like involuntarily throwing up or something, you know, and like, and then it's there. But I think rather than me feeling like, I mean, I don't think any of my opinions are, you know, right in any shape. Who knows, you know, like, so it's not that I feel that I need to share my opinions. It's like more that I kind of want to talk about them. And if anything, my opinions come out quite flippantly when I'm writing a song. And then from constantly doing that, it's shaped me as a person and it's made me feel stronger about, you know, my thoughts on the environment or my political beliefs, whatnot. Certainly I had, you know, like I had a lot less opinions on all of these things when I started writing songs than I do now. And if I get into a deep discussion with someone, I'll often be referring to my own songs, basically. Like, because it's like, not like quoting myself or anything like that, but more like, you know, how do I feel about this? I know how I feel about it because I've got a song about it that no one's heard of, an album 4 years ago. All right, sometimes I quote myself, but I never let anybody know.
And you've got an LP out at the moment, haven't you?
Mm. Two. Yeah, I did two records this year. One that was always going to come out this year. Called Knee Deep in Nostalgia, which was released on my 40th birthday. And is a nostalgic album about a song about my teacher at school, a song about my years in Camden in my 20s, and you know, sort of like, not all of it, but the overarching theme of the album is a kind of like wistfully looking back down memory lane. And then obviously with the fucking pandemic and all that, there was a lot to write about there as well. So there's another album which was just written during lockdown and recorded at home, just me and a guitar, and the songs just didn't gel at all, like at all. So the natural thing was to, you know, release two albums. The other one was produced by Frank Turner and is like a full band, you know, not that there was ever a full band, but we had musicians record parts and send them in, and Frank did the most of it in all fairness. So one's a kind of full band affair, the other's solo, and again it's one of them other massive flukes for me where it was definitely a creative choice to do it like that. One, I had the songs, and two, it was just like, right, I'll do two albums. But for a year without touring, it's been an absolute financial lifesaver, because everybody that was normally buying my albums has bought two. So when I was like, you know, how are we gonna sort of make ends meet here without no festivals, no tours, two albums, you know, was the answer, it seems. And it's, so my songs have saved my ass again, you know, even though it wasn't like, this is a marketing plan, you know, let's do two records. Although saying that, the only other person I know that's released two albums this year is Taylor Swift. So, you know, I must be on to something.
Has that done your lifestyle, like a bit of a time out from touring? Or do you love that? Have you enjoyed the family life during the pandemic?
I mean, I've got a two-year-old, so it's all been about, you know, spending time with her, and what a wonderful time to be able to, you know, to be able to have. And like, you know, obviously, because I've not been able to let the tragedy of the world come into our house, because that'd just be bad parenting as well. So the bubble instantly went up, and it was like, whatever's going on outside there, you know, even when we couldn't go out, it's like, you know, we're building playgrounds inside. That's me quoting myself. That's a line from my song. So yeah, that's, and it's also, I mean, I can't wait to gig again, and I would have much rather everything, you know, the world was how it was, or even better. I'm certainly not, I'm not going to cry about it, or you're not going to hear a sob story from me about it, because I think if anything, it's like, yeah, there was no Glastow and I was really looking forward to it, but I've been to, you know, Glastow 20 times, you know, like, what I worry for is the 19-year-old that was going to go for his first time. That's who I'm gutted for, you know, like, and the people that are, I don't know, that we're going to have a summer of fucking getting laid and, you know, meeting new people, and it'd be like,
oh, uni, and going freshers and that stuff, you know, that's.
Yeah, so I'm not going to moan, you know, a 40-year-old man that misses out on one tour. And even festivals, it's like, yeah, you've not done any festivals. It's like, last year I did 30-odd, you know, and it's like, so if, you know, if, again, I'm just in no place to complain about it. But, you know, obviously my feeling, my feelings of my sort of personal experience up against my feelings of the world of a whole are, you know, are vastly different. And hopefully in this podcast, we're not going to get stuck into my thoughts and fears about the future of the world as a whole.
It doesn't sound like you have a routine, mate, or does it? Like you said, the song will just hit you, or do you spend a couple of hours a night writing and singing songwriting?
The writing just happens whenever, really. I mean, it depends what's going on. There's a reason I had two records out this year, and that's because there's more time spent at home. But I definitely have routine. Like, no routine in songwriting, but routine in everything else. I mean, I release an album on the same day every year. And through that, again, that was something that started as just like a, without a plan. It was like the album was ready around my birthday. The first year I did it, it was like a bums on seats thing. It was like a few people were coming to my gigs and my mates had stopped. You know, it's a very important time in a sort of performer or a band. When you start off, I mean, who's going to come and watch you play live? Only your friends and family. And you can only count on them for X amount of time, and you basically, through the time that you've got them bums on seats, you need to get other people in that you don't know that might be interested in watching you perform. And I was sat on that fence, basically. It's like my friends were just like, mate, I've seen you play loads of times, I can't come anymore. And some people that I'd never met had just started coming, so I was like, I'll have a birthday party, and then my mates will come, and it'll be my album launch, and then the people that want to come to the gig will come, and it'll be a full room, and it'll be the launch, we'll launch the album that way. So that was the sort of why I did. And then a year later, there was another album ready. So it's like, fuck it, let's just do it on the birthday again. And then a year later, the same thing happened. And then it was a thing. And since then, you know, this year was my 12th year of doing that. And there's been, as much as it started off like that, it's got so many benefits for it, which sort of, I don't know, it's sort of, we realized over time. I mean, and mainly being, you can just plan so far in the future. Like, I always know that I'll be ready to record an album around September, basically. So I'll write up until September, and then like, and it, the minute that I meet someone, it's like, oh, I produce records. Generally, I go, do you want to make an album this September? Like, if there's anything that, that interests me, bang, I'll just go, right, let's make a record. We'll do it in September. If I meet any musicians, I say, I'm going to be making a record this September. Do you want to be on it? And I could just throw all that out and then collate it all in September. And I know it's going to be then. We can also book tours. We know there's going to be an album tour in December and another one in February. We just book that the minute that the other one's done, because there's definitely going to be, you know, there'll be an album there. So we could just move, you know, move towards it. And then people like the kind of, it turns into a tradition. I mean, the only thing I don't really like about it now is it's quite gimmicky. And it comes up a lot in interviews and whatnot. People are like, oh, it's, you know, another, but it's,
fuck
it's, yeah, exactly. I mean, I've got other gimmicks. But it's like, and through that, it just, and I always also find that the period between the recording of the album in September and the kind of release of it in December is always when I find that's a really good time for writing for me, because I've spent so long concentrating on the songs that are on the album. And they're kind of like, them ships have sailed, you know, they've gone. And you'd never then catch me replaying one of them songs, because I fucking know them so much from recording them and listening to them. So I always sit down with, and going back to what I said at the start, is that I don't know how to play anybody else's songs on the guitar. So I write the album goes out, I pick up the guitar, and it's like, instantly, I write the first song for the next album, then, like, it, to keep in with, and so in many ways, I do have, like, schedules and traditions very much.
But then, so you're writing for quite a long time of the year for that 1 year album.
Writing forever.
Yeah.
Always writing.
How do you then knock them out? How do you go, well, that's in the album, that's not? How does your list work? Do you have a little focus group? Do you have your mates and your wife, or who is it with you?
Just me and my spliff. I think now I write albums more as much as I write songs. Like, I'll often, I used to just, like, my early records were definitely like a collection of songs. And more recently, my, like I said, this record, they have like overarching themes. I'll also sort of like, I'll write a song and be like, that's a good second song. Or, you know, like, or, oh, this album's short of this. Or that's a good last song. So it's sort of, or fucking hell, I've been banging on about this too much, I need to talk about something else. Most songs that I write, I'd say 95% of the songs that I write, I end up releasing. I don't really vet my songs or throw any away. If it's got across the finish line, then, you know, it can stay for good. It will be like, there's not very often that I'll be like, oh, that song's not going to fit on this album, so I'll shelve it and put it on another one. It has happened. There's a song on the new album called Your Old Mate Beano, which is about, it's a kind of joke song that I wrote when I was in Australia, and I wrote it in the middle of writing an album called The Inevitable Trainwreck, which is about the rise of AI, the collapse of civilization, and, you know, climate change, and it just wasn't going to have like a joke Australian song on it. So I was like, fuck, there's no room for it. So I just, and it's now on this new album that just sort of, that crossed over. But not very often, normally, because a lot of the time the album is how I'm thinking. So it'd be like, yeah, it's like, this is my mindset. And sometimes I'll be like, certainly like for the album I'm about to write, I've been kind of wanting to write it at the end of this one. Like, I'm like, oh, I can sort of feel it coming. And it's like, right, wrap this one up, you know. And then during the recording process, I guess that's the only time that I wouldn't really write. And that varies from being a month to a weekend and with other people. But when I'm focusing on recording the album, you're not writing anything new, maybe the odd line here and there. But, you know, you lock down, do the album. And then it's that release. It's when that, oh, fucking hell, right, that's done. That's when I always go, I find it really exciting to pick up the guitar at that point and not have to concentrate on them songs. And that's generally where I, you know.
Does that match? So yeah. When you release the stuff, do the public's opinion or favourites match with yours at all?
Yeah, definitely. You know an absolute banger. When you've got it. And I say that as in within my own repertoire, not like, I've just written a hit. But yeah, you can tell, you can tell straight away, and some of them you kind of get a little bit wrong, or sort of like, oh, I thought that. But I also, if I've, and taken this year out of it, but if there's not very often that I finish writing a song before I play it live, if you know what I mean. If I'm halfway through writing a song and I've got a gig, there's a good chance I'll just open with it because it's what I'm thinking about. It's like, guys, I got a new song. Wait till you hear this. And sort of like, and just go straight in with it. And so you get a feel from it from that. But yeah, you can tell. Like, this is, you know, you do, also I find that with the way that I do my records, you know, I guess I have singles essentially, but in my head I sort of like, there'll be three songs from each album that I'll make a music video for, and that will be singles, and I'll know them again on writing. Certainly the songs, a lot of the times I come up with a music video while I'm writing it, because it is kind of a visual thing, and it's like, this is the song and this is going to look epic if I present it in this way. And that sort of pushes it forward. That's sort of another sign of a kind of a good song. You know, I've met a few, for want of a better word, kind of chancers throughout the years. They're like, hey, I'm going to, you know, we can do this. Oh, my God. You know, like, but certainly in the States, you know, I toured a lot out there and met a lot of people. They're like, oh, we're going to do this and blah, blah. And I always, you know, I'll always sort of take their word for it and go like, cool, yeah. But never really expect anything. But, you know, give people chances. And it's just... Again, it's just like there's not enough juice for anybody else to kind of have any, basically. So it's not really going to benefit anyone. I don't think anybody, if this could get pushed further and to a wider audience, I don't know who's going to be able to do it apart from me, you know, like, and certainly in the right way. So, and you know, and that's kind of why I also, you know, get sort of relatively ignored by the music industry and the music press and stuff like that, which is, you know, and that's not a sort of bitter songwriter saying that. It's, you know, it's kind of fine with me. Just, I, you know, long may it continue. If I could just keep on doing this, then fuck, I'd be well happy.
Well, like, finally, with the last question, Beans, is like, what you're content, I can see that. Plans for the future, what hasn't been ticked off the bucket list?
I mean, I'd just like to just keep on doing it. Like, release an album on my 50th birthday, I'd be happy.
If you want to hear more of Beans' stories, which you should, he's got loads of them. He's got a new book release coming out on August the 10th. The book's called Foolhardy Folk Stories. Head over to his website, beansontoastmusic.com. Go get it!
Beans, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for getting in touch.
Lovely.
Take care, man.
Have a good rest of the evening, mate.
Take care, man.
Bye-bye.